Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Rethinking Wealth and Inequality in America. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Gar Alperovitz, who's one of our scheduled speakers for this evening, did have a last-minute schedule mishap, and so he will not be with us tonight. He is the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland. Lou Daly, who is with us tonight, is Gar's colleague and co-author of their latest book, which I'll speak to in just a moment. Lou is a senior fellow and director of the Fellows Programs at Demos, a policy think tank in New York City that specializes in democracy reform work as well as economic policy work on the middle class. Lou is a writer on religion, political development, and economic thought, with recent books including God and the Welfare State, and his major work in this area due out next fall, The Caring State, Religion and Government in a New Welfare Age. Lou was previously a fellow of the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy, where he worked closely with then-President Bill Moyers on special projects. Before he began his writing career, Lou did pastoral work in a federal prison, as well as community organizing on labor issues. With a BA degree from Oberlin College, he holds advanced degrees from Brown University, the University at Buffalo, and Union Theological Seminary. He will be sharing ideas and issues with us tonight from the newly released book that he's co-authored with Gar Alperovitz. And the book is provocatively entitled Unjust Deserts, How the Rich Are Taking Our Common Inheritance and Why We Should Take It Back. Please join me in welcoming Lou Daly.
Thank you. Thank you for coming tonight, and thank you for your interest in the ideas that we're going to discuss tonight. Thank you also to the Commonwealth Club of California for hosting me, and especially Tom Waller for sponsoring me. It's truly a great honor for me to be here. America, of course, is the wealthiest country in the world. It is also the most unequal country in the advanced world, also the most impoverished and incarcerated country in the advanced world, by wide margins on all three fronts. That all of that was true in 1980, much more so today. I want to focus on wealth to begin with, because wealth is the assets of our society. Wealth is the place where people get a foothold in the mobility that people need, that families need to achieve the American dream. So what is the situation in terms of our distribution of wealth today? Take one snapshot. These statistics are always just snapshots, but from the year 2004, we had about $30 trillion of privately held assets in our economy. How was that wealth distributed? The top 5% of households had about $13.6 trillion worth of those assets. The bottom 90%, basically most of the rest of society, had about $13.9 trillion. So essentially, the top 5% had the same amount as the entire rest of society. But if you drill down a little deeper and look at the bottom half of American households, and assets are really important to that group of 150 million people, because that's having assets is what's going to allow them to achieve the American dream. They only had $1.8 trillion out of the total of 30, which is less than 6% of our total wealth. So 50% with less than 6%, 5% with approximately 50%. We should also look at what's happened to wages in the last three decades. On average, wages have stagnated And for a significant fraction of households, wages have fallen. Even more disturbing, wages and productivity have diverged. Between 1950 and 1980, our productivity gains over that period totaled about 90%. Wages over that same period rose about 89%. That's what you would call just desserts, wages rising in proportion to the increased value being generated in our economy because of productivity. Since 1980, productivity and wages stopped rising together, and the wealth from productivity basically started flowing almost exclusively to the top. For example, since 2000, productivity rose a total of 20%, while wages rose less than 1%. So the question we raise in our book, and the question I want to focus on today, is how do we understand such inequalities in an advanced economy? Are such inequalities less fair and therefore more justifiable to be rectified because of the nature of our economy today as compared to previous eras? Put the question more directly, shouldn't the way we produce our wealth have something to do with how we think about the distribution of wealth? And then what about the moral assumptions at the foundation of our whole debate on these issues? Do the highly individualistic moral assumptions that shape, if not govern, our debates about distribution and related policy matters such as taxation, that view being essentially, if I got something from the market or from anywhere, including my rich daddy, for a long time, people have been trying to eliminate the estate tax as unjustified. I deserve it. There are no other kinds of competing claims. And if you tax it or affect it in any way, you're basically a thief or a tyrant. So the question is, do those very strong assumptions hold up anymore? That is, do they accurately reflect how wealth is created, and therefore why it's okay for us to be so unequal? Not by a long shot. In fact, those assumptions are almost totally and irrevocably obsolete. They haven't always been obsolete, but they are today. So my objective here is to try to sketch our reasoning as to why that is so. The first thing I think we need to understand, and we saw this pretty strongly in the campaign last fall, a certain kind of debate where the basic assumptions are these. On the one hand, there is a private economy, purely engineering itself through the mechanism of self-interest, where individuals, through their effort, and only through their effort as individuals, get a return from the market, and therefore they deserve that, and that's the end of the story. So you have the pure market on the one hand, and then the bright red line between that and, on the other hand, government and the idea that the public should have a share of the wealth and the public should have the power to, in some ways and in some measure, reallocate that wealth. So the one is private and good and for the individual, and the other is socialistic and tyrannical and bad. The problem with that, the problem with focusing on government as something that is somehow socializing wealth, is that it doesn't take into account how much the private economy, even prior to the involvement of government, is highly, highly socialized in itself. There are many kinds of social institutions, not only governmental institutions, all the way up to the idea of a cultural evolution of learning going on within society that amount to a certain kind of socialization that's going on in that private sphere and enabling our productivity in ways that can only be attributed to society, not just to individuals. And so that bifurcation is a false kind of dichotomy. So let me just give you one example of what I'm talking about. If you look at the economic impact of public education, all of the collective investment of parents, of teachers, of school systems, of policy structures to support our schools, the education that goes on to train teachers, all of that had a huge economic impact in the 20th century. As much as 15 or 18% of our total growth in the last century is attributable to the investments we made in public education. And the reason is because those investments helped make our workforce much more productive than it was. Yet, when we look at our paychecks and we get angry about tax, you know, the line items of all the taxes that are taken away, I guess it's about a third if you look at the total tax burden, state, local, and federal. There is no line on our pay stub informing us of the 15% social premium we received from society in our individual productivity, in our pay, because of the long-term impact of public education. All of that is left out of the account. Now, bring it back to a more personal frame of mind. So you turn on the light in the evening. You turn on the light in the very early morning when it's still dark to get a head start on your day, maybe even already starting to work. You're doubling the available light in a day compared to even the wealthiest aristocrat of only a century and a half ago. So you have that light to work by and do more work by. You have that light to learn by, to communicate by. You have more light, and it is safer, and it is nearly free. Now, how much more productive are you with the light as compared to without it? And what does that increase? And this is the corresponding question. What does that increase of your productivity due to the availability of cheap electricity and light ultimately have to do with you? When you wash your hands, the dirty water goes away. The clean comes back at the turn of a knob. Cities and populations rose and fell for lack of such inflow and outflow. Only a century ago. In most of the world, they still do. But did you know that the doubling of life expectancy in the last century was almost entirely a product of public investments in the control of infectious disease? Why else do you think life expectancy grew dramatically in socialist countries as well? The productivity gains due to rising life expectancy, which were huge, they were a gift from society. How productive would you have been today without your computer, without the network behind it, without the software inside it? Think of it this way. What would that have cost you, that capability, if you actually had to pay for the vast inheritance of knowledge behind each of those three dimensions of low-cost computing, hardware, software, and network? We pay pennies on the dollar for these capabilities relative to their value. The rest comes from society. How many more people know about my book? How much more productive am I, in other words, in my job, which is to share ideas? Because I got to sit in a radio studio today and broadcast my ideas over the airwaves instead of just in the lecture hall, in the staff meeting, at the dinner table, and in the dark, lonely corners of my mind. So you think about the producers we are and the characteristics we typically use to measure each person's deservingness. Most importantly, how hard we work, how we apply our mental capabilities for productive purposes. Take a little thought experiment. What if you woke up tomorrow and all of the capabilities that you relied on today, but that you yourself did not create or maintain or pay for at anywhere near the full cost of the value they provide? What if all of that was taken away? How productive would you, the very same person that you were yesterday, be tomorrow? Probably not much more productive than a person alone in a state of nature. What does that tell us about where our productivity is coming from? Another way to put it would be to focus on a particular engineer and a particular field, engineering. So if today's high earners, for example, in engineering, are typically highly educated, this is not primarily because they are more intelligent or work harder, and it's not mainly because they were lucky in the birth lottery, which some argue as a justification for redistribution. Above all, they are highly educated because there is more knowledge for them to obtain and more access to that knowledge for them, more opportunity to obtain that knowledge. So Stanford economist Paul Romer puts it this way: a college-educated engineer working today and one working 100 years ago had the same human capital, the same intrinsic qualities of labor and intelligence that we use to measure deservingness. But the engineer today, working today, is far more productive. He can solve many more problems in the course of a year. He can solve more difficult problems. The reason is self-evident. He or she can take advantage of all of the additional knowledge accumulated as design problems were solved during the last 100 years. Two individuals 100 years apart, the individuals are the same. The one who came later in the development of the society was much more productive. But what does that have to do with that individual as compared to the value of the knowledge accumulated by society? So where do such examples and thought experiments lead us in the debate about inequality? To answer that question, I think we need to actually dig even a little bit deeper and actually get a bit more technical, so bear with me. Fundamentally, we're talking about where wealth comes from and why it's important for us to understand where wealth is coming from to be able to address issues such as inequality, who deserves what. The time horizon, though, has to be much longer than we typically use in such debates, because ultimately what we're talking about, in a sense, is what the living owe the dead, about how society has preserved the advances created by previous generations and what this cumulative inheritance, I'm going to come back to the meaning of that term, what this cumulative inheritance of human learning contributes to our current economic activities and well-being. So to understand the impact of this inheritance, we need to grasp some basic facts about economic growth and how we accumulated our wealth. So we need to know what the growth record has been and how our growth has changed in the modern era. Basically, the story is that we've moved from a labor-intensive, small-scale farming economy to a knowledge-based information economy. In the process, the sources of growth have changed radically. But it's important to understand, going back to my earlier point, that individuals have not really changed. We work no harder today than our ancestors did in 1800 or in the ancient past, and just the same, we're no more intelligent in terms of basic brain capacity, reasoning, and so on. The cave paintings of earliest human culture were works of roughly the same basic intelligence as the theory of relativity. Let's hold that thought. We work no harder and are no more intelligent than our ancestors from the near or even the ancient past. And yet, our economy is more than 1,000 times larger than it was in 1800. And the best measure of prosperity, which is per capita gross domestic product, essentially how much wealth there is in our economy for every person, is 20 times higher today than it was in the early 19th century. Now, of course, economic growth, has always been based on some combination of labor and equipment, labor and capital, and also knowledge. I mean, this has been recognized. Francis Bacon in the early 17th century was already developing, in a certain way, a theory of the knowledge economy. What's different today is the sort of the recipe, the balance of ingredients is very different from what it used to be. Now, how do we know this? We know this by looking at the economic research. So after World War II, economists began to formally study economic growth, and they developed a method known as growth accounting. This was developed to measure the sources of growth because, you know, this is a very technocratic era, so the idea being that if you can understand the sources of growth, you can begin to develop policy frameworks for improving growth. So the pioneer in this work, some of you probably know, was MIT economist Robert Solow, who in a brief but now famous paper published in 1957 made a startling discovery. Later, he won the Nobel Prize for this research. Now, in contrast with the then dominant assumption that capital accumulation, employers supplying more factories and more machines, essentially, was the main engine of economic growth, Solow found that less than 13% of our growth in the first half of the 20th century could be attributed to capital accumulation, or, for that matter, increases in the labor supply. In fact, the labor supply per person had been going down with the establishment of the 40-hour week. Most of the growth was not coming from, in other words, the conventional inputs of labor and capital, what we normally think of as economic activity, what workers and employers supply, in a sense. So the nearly 88% of growth that remained unaccounted for in Solow's model, this became known as the Solow residual. In economics, a residual is what's left over when you've made the calculation, when you solve the equation. This became a great mystery within economics. What it seemed to do is basically leave growth almost entirely unexplained. It was outside of the model. It was exterior to what economics measures. So this residual, Solow concluded, had to be understood as something broader and deeper than the everyday economic activity embodied in labor effort and capital accumulation. He defined it as technical progress in the broadest sense, a very famous formulation. Or, as I would put it, the cumulative knowledge and technological capabilities of our society. This did not make any sense in terms of our traditional, highly individualistic way of thinking about economic activity and, correspondingly, economic rewards. So within economics, the residual, as I said, remained a great mystery, and there's controversy and debate over it to this day. Other studies in growth accounting have a lower residual, a lower amount coming from technological progress, but the broad range is about anywhere between 64% and 90%. So then the question for me, not an economist, is to think about, well, what are some other ways of actually looking at the residual and figuring out, well, where is our wealth coming from? And actually, Solow basically at one point gave up and said, we need to have an interdisciplinary focus on this. We need to start looking at the sociology of science, economic history, the history of technology, if we're really going to understand this. So one of the strongest bodies of evidence that we look at to understand this is the history of technology. So popular culture and much of our education promotes a heroic view, what we call a heroic view of progress. This obscures how most technologies really develop. The heroic view sees progress simply as a sequence of great achievements by extraordinary individuals. It's the view that Albert Einstein, surely an extraordinary individual, rejected when he famously said, "Many times a day, I realize how much my inner and outer life is built upon the labors of my fellow men, both living and dead." the reality is much closer to Einstein's view of building on others' labor over a long duration, from transportation to medicine to computers to metallurgy to pharmaceuticals. Technological progress is much less about isolated eureka moments than about recombining existing knowledge in new ways. An individual may hit upon something new that adds to the existing knowledge and makes it more effective. But really, the key is how the existing knowledge predisposes the individual to look for certain things within a narrow range of possibilities. This is a condition that makes discovery almost an automatic process over time. And it's plainly illustrated in the very common and well-known and much-studied phenomenon of simultaneous invention, where two or more people, often 12, often dozens, working independently of one another, invent or discover the same thing at roughly the same time. Famously, Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace both discovered the theory of evolution by natural selection at the same time. Or take perhaps the most famous example, the telephone. The very day Alexander Graham Bell, or rather his lawyer, filed for his patent on the telephone in 1876, so did Elisha Gray, who had come from Ohio, but got there 4 hours later. It's possible that the only reason another inventor, very interesting man who was actually an Italian immigrant and a stage technician of all things, named Antonio Meucci, actually had a design, diagrams for a design for basically the same device, but one at the time would have been much more effective than what actually won the patent. Well, he didn't have $40 in his pocket 4 years earlier when he wanted to file his patent on the telephone. So that evidence tells me that none of these individuals, quote unquote, invented the telephone in any strict individualistic sense. Graham Bell's heroic contribution was simply that he won the race to obtain the legal title to an invention that was about to happen anyway. In a sense, and I know this sounds socialistic, but in a sense, the individuals, in many examples, you see this. The individuals are substitutable. If you took one out, if you took away Alexander Graham Bell from the picture, if he had never been born, would we not have had the telephone? Obviously, we would have, because by the evidence of all of his competitors that were trying to get legal title to the very same device at the very same time. So what this tells me is that the value is not really in the individual as much as in the knowledge. Certainly not in the individual to the degree that justifies the kinds of vast fortunes that people build by having that piece of paper and winning a patent race. So what does it mean to say that the value is in the knowledge? And this is where it starts. Our argument starts to get perhaps a little far out, but bear with me. So Romer's suggestion of the engineer, I think, suggests something deeper about the cumulative impact of expanding knowledge and something that has consequences for how we think about inequality. Basically, the picture in my mind is knowledge growing and as expanding, kind of going this way. But the individual, in terms of the intrinsic capacities that we use to measure deservingness, basically remaining flat over centuries. So there's more knowledge per person, better accessibility to knowledge per person. In that scenario, in that way of looking at it, you can't help but conclude that, in a sense, the locus, the location of value generation, where our wealth is coming from, is shifting from the individual to society over time. And this, in turn, means that our conventional individualistic basis for judging economic differences no longer holds. How do we measure who deserves what in an era of knowledge-based growth, where the knowledge of society is increasingly more important than individual effort or intelligence? So clearly, the way we talk about and think about inequality doesn't account for the enormous free lunch. So many economists still seem to believe that there is no free lunch. The enormous free lunch of inherited knowledge at the heart of our growth, at the heart of our wealth. So this brings me back to the idea of inheritance. And that's really, morally speaking, what we hang our hat on at the end of the day, that people will begin to understand that our knowledge inheritance has significant implications for addressing inequality. How should we view the concept of inheritance as a sort of moral proposition that's relevant for our time? I think step back and ask the question, how is inherited knowledge like and unlike inherited wealth and property? So most people don't consider inherited wealth or property to be something people really and fully deserve to enjoy. We have much more respect for Bill Gates than we do for Paris Hilton, even if they're legally entitled to it. So we never think the rich heiress really deserves to be rich. At the same time, we tend to see wealth and income people get from the market as something that is deserved because there is a corresponding effort. The market, we assume, rewards people roughly in proportion to their contributions. The problem with this is that a significant portion of what people get from the market today has nothing to do or less and less to do with what they individually contribute and more to do with what society contributes. So if you took away the inherited knowledge from every productive act, the knowledge that's embodied in the technological capabilities that people rely on to be productive, if you took that away, our productivity as individuals would plummet. And with that, so would our income. So in accounting for the knowledge we inherit, we have to ask ourselves, if we are really so much more deserving than the rich, you know, heiress lolling about on dad's estate. Obviously, what we add is important, and it has something to do with the differing economic benefits people enjoy. Yet, I would submit that the difference between what the high-tech CEO contributes and what the janitor who cleans out his wastebasket contributes is ultimately very small compared to the share of everyone's gains that comes from inherited knowledge. And what this means is that ultimately a large fraction of our wealth, of our national income, of our assets is, as we put it, morally available for redistribution, for addressing problems of inequality. Now, I don't like the word redistribution, and I would like to retire the word redistribution from the political vocabulary because it doesn't make sense. You can't redistribute something that is already highly socialized to begin with, namely the wealth and income we as individuals get from a highly advanced knowledge economy. So whoever ends up owning it, we need to account for those social contributions, and our wealth is highly socialized. So it's a false dichotomy to call what government does redistribution and ignore how society is already redistributing wealth within the private economy by doing things that enables our productivity. Most importantly, more to the point, individual productivity is increasingly dependent on what can only be described as a collective good, a common inheritance of knowledge. And in a strict moral sense, no one deserves to benefit from this common inheritance more than anyone else because it's not created by any individual. So to the extent that inherited knowledge, technical progress in the broadest sense, as Solow termed it, is increasingly driving our economic growth, I would submit that the fruits of knowledge, the wealth being generated by knowledge, should be more equally shared. Wealth that is commonly created should be equally, or at least more equally, shared. That's the fundamental point of what we're arguing in our book. Now, let me conclude here with another kind of question, a question about culture that I hope might sort of open things up for discussion. So this is a question about American culture, and I think it's a very difficult question. And let me raise the question by quoting one of my heroes, and I'm sure one of yours, Thomas Paine. In a little-known but profound late work called Agrarian Justice, which was published in 1796, Thomas Paine said this: "All accumulation beyond what a man's own hands produce in nature." Notice that bright red line, beyond what a man's own hands produce in nature, derives to him by living in society. And he owes on every principle of justice, of gratitude, and of civilization a part of that accumulation back again to society from whence the whole came. That tradition, that idea of that we owe a debt for what we've been given, that much of what we have derives to us from sources other than our own intrinsic worth, is actually an ancient idea. It arguably goes back to the Bible, Gospel of Luke: to whom much is given, from him much will be expected. So when I'm called a socialist for making this argument, I have to, I often quote Gospel of Luke back to that person, and that kind of changes the tone of the conversation. This is how St. Ambrose, who was Augustine's great teacher, put it, and he was giving a sermon to sort of wealthy Christian patrons who were hemming and hawing about the demands from the episcopacy for more almsgiving. And he conveyed to them in this sermon what was, in fact, the traditional Christian position, that almsgiving is a command of justice, basically a form of taxation and not an expression of personal virtue. So this is how he justified that position. He says, "The earth belongs to all. It's commonly given by God, not to the rich. But the people who have their shares already were in the realm of distributive justice way, way back then in the Dark Ages. The people who had their shares are fewer than those who do not. Therefore, you, the wealthy patrons who don't want to give alms, you are actually paying a debt. This is something you owe. It's a moral crime not to pay into the church's treasury for poor relief. You're not bestowing a gift." So I guess the question that I'm left with, and I don't know the answer to the question, and it's something that's been bothering me for a long time: how is it that the philosophical elites, the political elites, Thomas Paine, Ambrose, the Christian authors of the Gospel of Luke, how is it that in comparatively underdeveloped societies, where in fact labor was the main source of wealth, small farming economy, farmer and his family takes the piece of land, plants the crops, tends the crops, harvests the crops, very labor intensive. Yet 300 years ago, 1,000 years ago, in a time when labor was much more important than it is today, they were able to recognize this divide, where as soon as you begin to go beyond that kind of economy, as soon as societies begin to emerge, as soon as the systems of society begin to emerge, let alone education, that the moral obligation arises, that entails a need for reciprocity for those social contributions. So that was a very clear moral insight in a time when societies were were very undeveloped compared to today. So why is it that we, in living in a comparatively highly developed society where economists are literally measuring the value of social contributions in terms of GDP growth, as I said, the range of 64 to 88% is sort of the average number that's put on that. Why are we unable to see the value of those contributions? Why are they left out of the account when we begin to think about and debate inequality, growing inequality, and the kinds of policies that we need to remedy that problem. As I say, I don't know the answer to that question. Protestant ethic on haywire, I don't know. But it's unique to American culture. I think that that's certainly true. Probably has a lot to do with the origins of our political economy in terms of the nature of our agrarian economy and the homesteading mode of production that we had compared to much more crowded Europe. Probably has to do with the fact of no sort of Catholic tradition in the U.S., compared to Europe and what Ambrose was talking about. But all of it adds up to a situation where, you know, we basically have an 18th century morality of the small farmer getting his return from the land, and that's all there is to it. We still have that morality even as we live in a highly advanced knowledge economy centuries later. So there's a contradiction there that I think can only be explained by something in our culture. And I don't think it's an idle question because, you know, given the magnitude of the social problems that we have now and with the danger of, real danger of government insolvency actually growing even as we speak, I don't think that's an idle question. And so ultimately the question is, how can we begin to account for the value of social contributions and to include that in our moral framework when we're talking about inequality on the principle, as I stated earlier, that wealth that is commonly created should be more equally shared than it is today. And that's really the whole point. So, does that carry us into a good Q&A?
So let's put our hands together and thank Lou Daly for his comments. Lou, I want to thank you very much. We're listening to Lou Daly, who's talking to us about rethinking wealth and inequality in America. And the challenge for us, I think, over the next, say, 15 to 20 minutes of our Q&A is to adhere to our normal Commonwealth Club protocols, which is in the form of Q&A, because I think the most fun would be if we all got in a circle of chairs and started talking back and forth about this. But so what I'm going to ask everybody, including myself, is to refrain from some verbal expositions of our points of view and instead to try to enable the speaker to tease some further thoughts out and so forth for clarification. I know Lou has a plane to catch in about 3+ hours, so we can't stay for terribly long afterward. But I was going to say was if we have some give and take and back and forth that a couple of you might like to do, he may have a few minutes to do that at the end. So anyway, we'll give it a try to see if we can stick to some type of a here's a question, what do you think about it? I guess I'd lead off with just asking for you to, as you've made this compelling case for this broadly developed, co-developed knowledge, which successful people draw upon as they go off to make their millions and billions, you've made that case, and I was just curious, what might we do about it? In other words, how do we now, after, let's say, probing and poking that the ideas that you've presented to us, what have you and Gar come up with about what on earth might we do about it?
Mm.
Since, as you say, the redistribution is kind of one of those words you'd like to put over in the...
Yeah.
And that's sometimes the trouble, these labels and words that we have, and the vocabulary fails us. So anyway, talk a little bit, if you would, about...
Sure. I think that I think you raise a good question. We are talking about redistribution, whatever you want to call it. Essentially, that we believe that the public share of our national income needs to grow, so that democratically we can reallocate it back into the middle and the bottom of society. Doing that effectively is no less important than morally understanding the problem, which motivates our action. So, we have a lot of focus in our book on questions of how to do this without collapsing the incentives of our economy and so on, and how to do it effectively in terms of policy. And I think the most natural sort of policy outcome of this argument is to guarantee equal access to a good education from K through college, which obviously we don't have now. So one of the policies we put forward is to just target, I don't like to use that word, but to focus on the wealth of the top 2% of households, which is about 2 million people, and those households have an average average worth of about $1 million each. And if you take 2% of that, say, annually for 5 years, leaving them with roughly $960,000 worth of wealth, I guess, that generates revenues of $80 to $100 billion. And that we put that in an endowment, a public endowment, that is then used to give tuition grants to students who have need for that. The idea being, as the endowment grows, we get to a point where our increasingly onerous student loan system, students graduating with $19,000, $20,000, $30,000 in debt, sometimes more, and going into a very competitive job market, you know, the upshot of that is that a college degree isn't worth as much anymore. But we can remove the burden of student loan debt by replacing that system with a pure tuition grant system. But the only way to get the money for that is to reallocate it from the top. So that's one example of the kind of policies that we think bear out the moral logic of what we're arguing.
Questions from audience?
Wouldn't increasing taxes be a way to redistribute the wealth? And don't we have a political situation in the country where the Republicans have been trying to get government office back and Democrats have been trying to say we have to take care of education and health, and it's sort of maybe it'll start swinging back towards the public good with the Obama administration?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, obviously the tax we're talking about for the tuition grant endowment is, you know, that's a tax. There are many other kinds of taxes you could implement wealth taxes. The only wealth tax we have in America is the estate tax, and that almost got killed. So even there, we have a very, oddly enough, given that Jefferson was a strong proponent of inheritance taxes. Oddly enough, we have an aversion to taxing wealth in America relative to other countries. But you know, I think that's one area, therefore, that you know, where there's room for exploration. Windfall taxes, obviously, on oil companies, those sorts of things, where you just have pure externalities, nothing that they're doing generating record-breaking revenues for them, no deservingness whatsoever in that situation. You know, those are things that one could target to put back at the disposal of society. So there's a lot of room at the top. I mean, it's important to remember that I had to chuckle when President Obama was accused of being a socialist for threatening to raise the top marginal tax rate from 35 back to 39%, which is what it was under Bill Clinton. In fact, when our country was most productive, when we had the best growth, and when most of the gains were going to the middle class, unlike today, this is in the 1950s and early 1960s, the Eisenhower years, the top marginal rate in our tax code was either 90 or 91%. So if Obama was a socialist, I guess that means Eisenhower was some kind of communist. I mean, it's really ridiculous. Historically, the pattern has been that more progressive tax systems generate better growth. And not coincidentally, as our tax code has gotten more regressive, beginning in 1980, our productivity has plummeted. I mean, we've had real declines over certain periods. When Bill Clinton raised the top marginal rate, it had been 74 in 1979, or 1980, plummeted down into the 30s in the 80s. Bill Clinton came in, he raised it back to 39, and I work in the think tank world, so there are dozens of reports, you know, from the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation, all the conservative foundations. The sky is falling. If you do this, all the elites are going to leave the country. They're going to send their capital overseas. You're distorting the incentives. You're foiling their expectations. It's just going to be chaos. Well, of course, we had the Clinton boom after he raised taxes. So it was what actually happened was completely contradicted what the theory was. And so, you know, I would say that the basic premise is that in a strict moral sense, we have the figure of 88% is the morally available social surplus. We don't propose raising tax rates to 90% on anyone, but we do think that there's a lot of room between, say, the 39 and the 91 of the Eisenhower years to begin moving in a more progressive direction. And that this won't harm our growth and, in fact, will improve our growth because if we reallocate that money intelligently in terms of investments in human capital in the American workforce, that will facilitate our growth.
Does that philosophy extend, for example, to sports, in which perhaps 5% of the athletes get huge salaries and 95% get rather meager salaries? Should the highly paid ones contribute, since the sport was developed by all, or in the case of artists of any kind, vocalists or actors, painters, any other profession who benefits from the evolution of that art form, should they share back to their so-called family?
Sure, but the magnitude of the undeservingness, I think, is lower there. So as a former athlete myself, former soccer player. I don't know. Someone once asked me this question. This is a very good question. I've gotten it several times, and I have to admit I haven't fully thought it through. I haven't really formulated an answer, but someone once asked me, now what about Bob Dylan? I was like, okay, what do you mean? What about Bob Dylan? He's a great poet. He's a great genius, and all his fame and fortune derives solely from his unique great genius as a poet, songwriter. And my response to that was, well, you're talking about Robert Zimmerman, right? That's Bob Dylan's name. The Dylan is Dylan Thomas. So all of his songs come out of poetry. All Along the Watchtower comes out of the Bible. It's famously a song he wrote after his motorcycle accident. So there, I guess I would sort of shift the focus that there's a technological commons that everyone's drawing on, there is a creative commons that everyone's drawing on. And I do believe that, you know, the same moral issues arise there. I just don't think I don't think that's where the real wealth is and where the real problem is in terms of inequality. I don't know if you want to compare Michael Jordan's fortune to Bill Gates, I think that would be pretty clear. So yeah.
That's the principle. I mean, Andrew Carnegie certainly made a different contribution than Andrew Steelmaker.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the telephone patents as sort of an example of spontaneous invention and sort of the inevitability of that invention. And sort of in a classical view, people would say that patents are incentivizing people to make these inventions, right, and have that heroic inventor. And it certainly seems that a lot of sort of knowledge-intensive industries like pharmaceuticals or high-tech are in the U.S. where we have this sort of very mercantile system that you were discussing. I was wondering, do you sort of view that if we didn't have this, is this sort of a loophole that these companies are taking advantage of, and without it, these advances would have come anyways? Or do you think that that does sort of offer an argument for providing people with more of the, how much of their, where is that line where you say, how much does Alexander Graham Bell deserve for his invention,
yeah,
and how much is our collective knowledge?
I think that's a good, really good question. I mean, I think our patent laws, you know, they have, you know, they're limited. It's not perpetuity of control. I don't know. I think it's 5 years, for example, on a pharmaceutical patent. So, and the theory is there. It's a complicated issue. So you need to have the patent in a certain range of time to incentivize people to invent things. I think that that's probably true, although I think that there are also ways of systems of collective invention that could also be established institutionally and legally that I think we underestimate the potential of that, and we're seeing some of that. Wikipedia is a good example. But I think there are two problems with the patent system. One is that there's patent gridlock. So people are able to patent smaller and smaller and smaller bits of knowledge. So for someone who sees the next advance, has that insight, they have to comb through 16 different patents on 16 different time frames to be able to get to have access to that knowledge. And recombine it for this new thing. So that's kind of a gridlock that's going on, and I think it's beginning to affect our technological progress. Ultimately, I mean, one example from pharmaceuticals is a very important and effective cancer drug called Taxol. Taxol, just to give you the numbers here so you can begin to understand the unjust deserts, Taxol had about $1 billion of public investment, about half in the form of research and development investments from the government and half in the form of Medicare payments, meaning that the government market for Taxol was a big source of the value of Taxol. So that's a social contribution. We haven't really talked about that, but that's also important. You had $9 billion of sort of worldwide revenues for Taxol for Bristol-Myers Squibb, who had the title to it, I think up through 2003. Only $33 million in royalty payments back to the government. So $1 billion in investment, $9 billion in revenues, $33 million in royalties. So you could get to a level of just deserts in that example if the royalty was equal to the value of the public contribution. But we have a long way to go there, as you can see.
During the campaign, they talked a lot about trickle-down economics and why that was no longer a functioning system for reallocation. Can you speak a little bit about why you don't believe that that will serve the purpose of the final outcome that you've been discussing tonight?
Yeah, so trickle-down economics, which is basically not an economic theory at all. It's a theory of taxation. I mean, all it is the idea that you need to lower the tax burden on wealthy people because that will then release their effort, release their incentives. And, you know, from there, all of the inventions, all of the technological progress will emerge, and everyone in society will ultimately benefit from it. So it's really, trickle-down is really kind of a theory of sort of removing public obligation from the wealthy to give them freedom to do what they and only they can do. I mean, we've had an experiment in trickle-down economics the last 30 years, and really acutely in the last 10 years, you know, in terms of lowering tax rates on the theory that this will boost our economic growth. We had a natural experience in that theory in 2001 and 2003. George Bush's tax cuts were skewed to the top. I think it was about 40% of the value of those tax cuts went to the top 1%. There's, you know, an attempt to do trickle-down economics. All that seemed to do was give people too much money, and it didn't make sense to invest in producing things because there wasn't enough buying power in the general public. So they did this financial thing. They started investing in themselves, essentially, buying worthless assets with borrowed money. And all of that, I think, is symptomatic of too much wealth at the top and not enough demand in the society. And so an economy like that tends toward the kind of financialization that's collapsing all around us today. So I just think factually, historically, trickle-down economics has been shown, you know, not to work. And I think the Obama administration, that's one of the clear, you know, lines that they've drawn in the sand. And they were able to win in doing that, which is significant.
From your background and from what you've said, there seems to be a clear moral message or a certain morality to what you're saying. Have you given any thought to how beyond writing, but how to sort of get that sort of message or put that, I don't want to call it spin, but put that emphasis on things, because, you know, we still have Republicans saying, well,
right,
we have to have more tax cuts, as you know, which is just like, are you people crazy?
Yeah.
You know, they're still insisting on that, and I'm concerned that the trickle down
right
explanation that you just gave is still not very widely out there.
Yeah, I think the American public strongly articulated what is essentially the principle of our book in terms of accounting for social wealth. When last fall, when former Treasury Secretary, feels good to say that, I have to admit, Henry Paulson came forth with his 3-page blank check for his friends on Wall Street, which is basically what the original financial bailout was designed to be. So there was a huge uproar. I mean, like, you know, huge uproar on this. And the sort of debate shifted into Congress, and people were able to voice their opinions to their representatives. And the overriding theory, the overriding theme and concern of that voice, that public voice, was that, okay, if we have to save, we, the taxpayers, have to save the financial system, many people didn't think we needed to, but assuming that we did at some level, well then, you know, society, we, the taxpayers, are going to have a stake in those assets in the form of ownership. So we're not just giving a blank check to the banks to give them more capital so that can push their, you know, can push their toxic assets off the book. No, we're going to have an ownership stake in these institutions. Now, that has happened haphazardly. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell where we have an ownership stake and where we just gave them blank checks right now. But the principle is the same. In other words, if society is going to play this role of saving the financial system, which is just one of the many things that we do collectively, then if and as those assets get turned around and begin appreciating in value, society is going to reciprocally enjoy part of that value. And that is, so that principle, which we hadn't, I agree, we hadn't heard that in a long time in our political culture, the idea of this kind of reciprocity, that came forth loud and clear last fall, and I really took heart in it.
Lou, we could go on for a long time here, and I think it would be an awful lot of fun, and I know you've got to get to an airplane, and we've got people who look forward to our one-hour presentation, so I guess I will take my prerogative of asking the last question. If you would comment, if you would, you mentioned not wanting to squash the notion of incentive.
Right.
That was part of your comments there. So please talk to that issue of incentive with regard to the matter of value-addedness, not only within ourselves, how do we continue to go through life trying to become more valuable, that is, value-able, able to add value through the acquisition of knowledge, skills, and abilities, and so forth. So not only the individual issue of becoming more valuable and value add and incentive, but also the notion of applied knowledge. In other words, you've made a great case for how we've got the great co-development of societal knowledge. But what about the application of that, the commercialization of it?
Sure.
You mentioned Alexander Graham Bell. Others would have done it. But is there any role in there for that aspect of rewarding that value addedness with
sure.
regard to commercializing that knowledge? So maybe if you could just touch on those two issues.
Sure. Yeah, there is. There's a lot of room, but there's the, I mean, take the internet as an example. So the internet began as a Defense Department project in the early 1960s. Many people know this is sort of a famous story now. And for 30 years, the development of the internet was financed by, in one way or another, by the government. In the 80s, it kind of got taken over by university systems. It wasn't until the early 1990s that, by law, the internet was privatized. So that was the point at which it became a marketable commodity, and where people like the people who eventually, you know, became the leaders of Google and so forth, they began to sort of get into the game of entrepreneurship because they saw this technology there and they wanted to apply it and improve it, the search capacities, the informational capacities. And that happened and it was privatized, and I think that was, you know, I think that was wise. I think we needed that right then because it had its public value under public control, which is basically university-based, had sort of come to an end. And it was only natural to begin to think about, well, how do we apply this in terms of ways that are actually going to impact our economy, as it turned out to be the case profoundly. The problem is then that all of that investment, the government bearing, and we through the government bearing all the risk and the cost, essentially, of developing that technology to the point where the risk was low enough for the entrepreneur to make that leap, to make that investment, is completely left out of the account in terms of how we treat, tax-wise or otherwise, the revenues of Google, for example. So, I think that there is room for both, but the problem is that our moral debate is entirely focused on the application of knowledge, not on the development of knowledge to the point where people are willing to take those risks. And I actually think that's a lot of the value is in that underlying development, more so than society's getting back in the form of taxation.
Any comment on the responsibilities of each person with regard to becoming more valuable as we make our journey through life? In terms of that, the personal responsibility of acquiring knowledge, skills, and abilities so we can add value to the enterprise, whatever it is.
My gut reaction to that, I'm not sure, but my gut reaction to that is that the structure of opportunities are so unequal that it's hard for me to answer that question.
Okay. Well, listen, let's put our hands together for Lou Daly, if we could. I sincerely want to, we've been listening to Lou Daly talking to us about rethinking wealth and inequality in America, and I certainly want to thank you very much and how much we appreciate you bringing what I think is some pretty provocative insights, and we don't always leave our Commonwealth Club events with all kinds of answers. If anything, we like to leave with better questions and to reflect further on what we've heard. So I want to thank you very, very much for that tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.